Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Hello, good evening. Welcome to Interchange here on WFHB. I'm your host, Ryan Dawes. In the past weeks, or months really, leading up to the election, we naturally focused on local, state, and national campaigns for office here on Interchange, providing exhaustive, in-depth coverage of these races, all of which can be found either at wfhb.org/news or at catstv.net. But if you're like me, you might now be experiencing a bit of a political hangover. So to cure us, we at Interchange sought something deliberately apolitical for our show tonight, something that I hope is universally relevant and intriguing, and that would be the topics of history and genealogy. Now, here in Monroe County, we are fortunate enough to have the Monroe County History Center as a resource for both ventures. The local history center is located on 6th and Washington in downtown Bloomington. And I have with me in studio here in the Firehouse Station, Elizabeth Schlemmer and Angie St. Clair, both from the Monroe County History Center. Elizabeth is the library manager, and Angie is the education and volunteer manager, both from the Monroe County History Center. Thank you both for being here on Interchange.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
Sure, it's our pleasure. So now the History Center has a lot to it, a lot of components that you offer the public. Now, would you both give us a, in case somebody has walked past it a million times and never actually stepped in, could you talk a little bit about, you know, what it offers and give us a very sensory tour of what you would see when you walk in and move throughout the facility?
Well, if you walked in the front door, you would probably be greeted by one of our volunteers at the front desk, and then you could move on to either the library or perhaps the gift store or the galleries. I guess if you walked back to the library, you would find we're in the old basement of the former Carnegie Library, and you would find other volunteers, a large card catalog, which might look a little antique now, and it's filled with cards for the books that we have, as well as newspaper clippings of old newspapers from the county, and many county ledgers of original records for Monroe County, including marriage records and court records. If you moved on beyond the library, though, and walked up through the galleries, would you like to take us
Sure. Sure, Elizabeth. We would end up on the second floor, which is our exhibit area. That's where I spend a lot of my time. Elizabeth, of course, spends her time, much of it. We're all over the building, but much of her time is in the library. Since I give tours, many times I'm on the second floor. And if you go to the second floor, you will see on either end, you will see galleries that change. We have a permanent gallery, the Gail Cook, the Gail Cook Gallery, and then we have two galleries that change. Currently, we have a Civil War exhibit in one of them, and the other exhibit's being changed for the Civil Rights in Bloomington area. And so if you went upstairs right now, you would see things in change. You would see the main gallery. You would see a giant Kodiak bear. As you come up the stairs, you would see a lovely Civil War display. You would see a display of voting in Bloomington, a exhibit of early doctors and dentists from Bloomington, including a bone cutting saw. And so that's what you would see.
Community Voices Gallery.
That's right.
Currently we have the Girl Scouts of Monroe County have an exhibit in the Community Voices Gallery. This space is used to host various community organizations who can put on their own exhibit to display their own history.
And that's going to change to the food bank coming up soon.
Nice, excellent. Now tell me, I'm interested, you have a lot to it. You have a bone saw, and you know, various, you know, doctor and dentist, as well as the Civil War exhibit. How do you come by objects to curate these various specific exhibits?
Well, we have a collections manager who works with our collections and exhibits committee. And we just have items that have been donated to us over time. And the committee and the collection manager decides what we keep for the museum. So it mostly comes from the public. So
new items come in every week throughout the week. People can donate during our regular business hours. You can come by if you have things that are in your attic or in your basement from your family that have to do with local history. And then it goes before a committee, and we talk about the items each week and discuss how they tell the story of Monroe County, whether they would be good for exhibit, and consider their condition. And then for things that we choose to keep, then they go through a process of being cataloged and preserved.
Now, how do you go about determining which objects are historical, which objects can you put into an exhibit, and then which objects do you just say, we have no use for this?
Well, our collections policy at least goes, obviously we're a local history museum, so objects that would be to most interesting for our museum would be local history. Then we go state, and then we go national, and then any other interesting items that we might come across that we feel like they are historically significant. So that's at least our policy.
We ask questions like, how is this related to Monroe County history? How is this related to a particular family, or does it tell one particular story? We would be more welcoming of items that are grouped together, that are an entire collection. For example, we had one man, a veteran, who donated his entire uniform from World War II. And so that's, you know, especially valuable because it's not just his jacket, but his pants and his boots and his can opener and his GI glasses. And so when we have those complete collections or photos that go along, when photos are identified with the people who are the subject of the photo, all those things make artifacts more valuable.
Now this kind of reminds me of what you might see on Antiques Roadshow, where people may have a certain amount of knowledge, or maybe they have no idea where this item came from and in what its use is. So what type of stories do you get? Do you feel like people are aware of the items that they bring in? They know why it pertains to Monroe County, why it's historic? Or do you feel like people are bringing in things that are like, you know, this looks old, I've never seen this before? Do you often get consulted yourselves?
Yes, we get things, we get items like that all the time. And we try our best to figure out what they are, and sometimes we have to consult with experts. I'm particularly thinking, Elizabeth, of the cannonball.
Exactly.
And I don't know, do we ever find out if indeed that was a cannonball?
I don't think that it was ever verified, but a woman came in. I think I was there when she brought it in, and it was a large, heavy metal ball, and she was wondering, could this be a cannonball?
Sure,
and
that's a good question.
Where she found it, and we consulted various people who are Civil War historians. I don't think it was ever verified, but it was also suggested by someone who was more of a limestone historian that it could have been a kind of ball bearing that would be used in some mechanical process of quarrying limestone.
Now that's a unique component to our local history, given that it's such a prominent industry, both present and past. What sort of displays or information can you find at the Monroe County History Center specifically pertaining to limestone?
Well, since I spend so much time on the second floor, do you mind if I take that?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. I spend a lot of time up there. We do have a limestone exhibit. We also have, what we like to do is just not make our exhibits visual. We like to have all sorts of components to them. So along with just visually seeing limestone items and artifacts and tools, we also have a documentary that's running. You will also see in that same area the other industries that were important to Bloomington. You'll see the Seward's ironwork. Austin Seward made the courthouse fish. There's information about his ironworks. There's also information about the Showers brothers, who where all our city offices are in the Showers brothers. If you come to the second floor, not only will you find out about the limestone industry, but you'll find out about the other industries that were important to Bloomington.
Now, as I understand, there are a lot of county government documents housed at the History Center. What use are these documents today, and what types of things are stored there, and from how far back?
Many of our county documents begin in 1818 with the beginning of the county. They're very useful for genealogists, especially marriage records, deed records, which would be transactions of land. We have early county court records and the early commissioner's books, so a big range of books that in other counties you would often have to go to the county courthouse to be able to look at them. So we're very lucky in that we've been entrusted with them and are able to serve the public by helping people research with them. And today, actually, I had a really interesting question. I had a local lawyer call up and ask if I could verify that the county commissioners owned the land on which the courthouse is placed, the public square. He needed primary documentation of their ownership. And I searched through deed records and couldn't find the specific transaction that he was suggesting, that the commissioners had bought the land from the federal government. In fact, I found a land patent that the federal government sold that section to a man named David Rogers. So then I had to trace through David Rogers that he sold that land to Benjamin Parks, who was an agent of the county. So then I went over to the commissioner's books and looked through the early commissioner's records and saw that Benjamin Parks was appointed agent of the county. That was his specific title. And he was put in charge of determining how the lots would be divided for the square, and so then I was able to make that connection, but it wasn't the direct jump that we were expecting. I kind of had to trace it through.
So wasn't the commissioners that owned it. It was this agent of the county. Interesting.
And then it said in all successors of that title. So then that would show that the commissioners eventually would be owners.
Do local officials or attorneys approach you often with research, especially when it comes to like maybe zoning petitions or something like that?
Mm-hmm. On occasion, with developments that are going on, building developments, sometimes as part of that process, I'll have to look at aerial maps for someone and try to determine how the land has changed through time.
I understand there are a lot of maps housed there as well. What sort of maps are there, and what are they depicting, and what's their use?
I'll let you take the maps.
Okay. We have many county plat maps, which are very interesting.
What is a plat map?
A plat map shows all of the owners of the land. So it's illustrated. You can see the county and the divisions, all the squares and various shapes, and a name on each of those squares of who owns that. And then those are also indexed. So you can look up if your great-grandfather owned a piece of land in Indian Creek Township in 1856, you can look at that and you can see where it was. We also have Sanborn maps are very interesting. We have reproductions of those. They are fire insurance maps that were made at various points in time where an agent of a fire insurance company would come out and map out the land and show. And these are for towns, so we have them for Ellettsville and Bloomington, and it shows exactly what is in each building. So you can look at the square, and you can go building by building and see what each one was being used for, that this is a milliner's, and this is a hotel, and this is a restaurant, and Seward's Iron Foundry. they're fascinating to just sit down and go to.
And it has the contents of the buildings as well listed?
Yes.
Wow. Interesting. Now, I want to talk a little bit about genealogy later because this question will relate to that. But are collections, because it seems like maybe at the time, you know, maybe in the mid-1800s, they were looking at these maps and they say, what are we going to use this for? We need it now, but then maybe a decade after it was used, they might become irrelevant. Why save it? Now we're so thankful that it's saved. What do we do now to make sure these documents, or are we all just assuming it's all electronic? Does it, because I'm trying to think of it in terms of if you were in their shoes choosing whether or not to keep all this stuff that may have seemed useless then, but then obviously it's very useful and intriguing to us now. You know, what when we put ourselves in those shoes, but then we're in the modern day dealing with modern maps, is there anything that's curated currently that sort of preserves, you know, this era that we're in now for, you know, 100 years from now when, you know, your successors were doing your jobs in 100 years?
Well, we are in their shoes now, and we do try to think forward to preserving recent history, that history doesn't have to be 50 years old or more. And we clip news clippings from things that are happening today that seem that they might be significant for the future. But many things, I think, are kept electronically. All the county records are kept electronically. We only have records from before 1959, I think. And obituaries are from today are being indexed on a weekly basis. So there are things that we know other organizations are keeping track of for the future, but we also try to pay attention to news clippings and also taking current oral histories of people who are living today who can speak about their lifetime.
And then, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, I know when I've gone through our photos, I know that we have photos in our collection that are as current as the 1980s. For example, the Civil Rights exhibit that's coming up, that runs from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So various people in Bloomington might consider that very current history. So we're not just dealing with things from the 1800s. We're definitely dealing with decades that are closer to us than not.
When the Beeline Trail opened, we have plenty of photos from that as being a historic event at the time.
Yeah, so yeah. You view that as your job just as much it is to preserve the things of the 1800s as it is, you know, the 2000s?
Yeah, well, we also had that collection come in from the women's bookstore. And we looked at that, and even though that was also very current information, we decided that was significant to the history of Bloomington. And
this was a feminist bookstore that was active in, I think, the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, the 80s, definitely.
Nice. Well, excellent. So we're going to take a quick break. I'm speaking here in Interchange with Elizabeth Schlemmer and Angie St. Clair. We'll be right back after this short break. Cool. We're back. You are listening to Interchange here on WFHB. I am your host, Ryan Dawes. Today we're talking about Monroe County history and the Monroe County History Center. I have with me in studio Elizabeth Schlemmer and Angie St. Clair, both from the Monroe County History Center. Now, this might be a really nerdy question, but we're talking about all these very important primary documents that people use for various, whether it's researching genealogy, whether it's with legal questions regarding the county. How do you preserve the paper that's this old? And I'm really intrigued by that. Is there a certain treatment or is there a certain protocol to making sure that the paper itself does not disappear and get damaged?
Elizabeth, why don't you talk to him about the archives, Nook?
We have quite a few old paper documents dating back as early as 1816. I think some of our earliest court records are from 1816. They are a little bit more fragile. And we unfold our court documents. It's important to keep them flat. And we store them in acid-free folders, archival folders, in acid-free boxes. Sometimes to get the creases out, we've actually had to flatten them in what I call our very high-tech humidity chamber. This is a tip that I picked up from the State Archives in Indianapolis, and basically it's under an underbed storage box, a Sterilite box, something like that, with about an inch of water in the bottom and a plastic grid.
Wow.
I cut this grid out, or I should say really a volunteer helped me with this. And
sure.
we got a plastic grid that is used for fluorescent lighting. I picked it up at a local hardware store. We cut it down to fit in the box so it sits in this tray so that it's just above the water. And we put the document inside and shut it for a couple hours, maybe 4 hours. And the document soaks up, the paper soaks up some of the water. Not a lot. It's not like it's damp. It's just a little bit heavy with moisture. And it loosens it up so then we can press it. And by pressing it, we just put it in between two very large deed books for overnight. And that typically flattens them, and that's what we had to do with a lot of court records.
All in the effort of getting out the creases.
Yes, yes, just to get out the creases. We also spend quite a bit of time cleaning court records. Before they were at the History Center, they moved around from a lot of different basements, including the basement of the courthouse, where there was apparently a coal-burning furnace. So they have soot on them. They're just,
oh my goodness,
black dust all over. And volunteers spend a lot of time cleaning them with rubber sponges before we put them back in their new acid-free boxes.
Well, we're going to get lots of volunteers for that, Elizabeth. Sign me up to clean the soot off the documents, please.
I don't know. That does sound kind of interesting, dealing with these primary documents. And, you know, you do have to be, I imagine, quite ginger.
Some of the paper's really nice. Paper from the 1870s is in really good shape, actually. They used a little bit more fibers in them, more of a fabric content, and they're in good shape. Yeah. Better than paper from the last 25 years or more.
Do you ever encounter any sort of marginalia, things that maybe weren't intended by the initial author of the document, and then you find something maybe in the corner, maybe a little footnote or some sort of...
Sometimes.
Some sort of commentary?
On occasion, I've seen a few illustrations or notes that I don't think are related to the document. It's pretty rare. What's more common that is kind of along the same lines, illustrations that are intended. For example, in older deed records, when someone signs, they'll say, "Witness my hand and seal." And sometimes they'll draw in the image of a hand or a seal rather than pressing in ink. They will write the word seal and put a circle around it rather than it being sealed with, or not with ink, but with wax. Rather than having a wax seal, they'll write seal.
I ask because my own birth certificate is covered with Crayola. Now, so we've been hinting at this during the first segment. This is a great resource the Monroe County History Center is for people researching their own genealogy. Now, Angie St. Clair, you yourself are a genealogy buff. You've done a lot of work researching your own family. And then you, Elizabeth, you have a lot of resources within the library. So talk a little bit about, say you're starting from scratch. Now, I myself am lucky. My aunt Marge, she is the genealogy buff. She's gone through and done all the research for us. And then we all reap the benefits by not having to dig. We just get the product and hear all the stories and have everything mapped out for us. Now, but say you're starting from scratch, and I'm wondering, does it matter whether or not you have family in Monroe County? Does it matter if you have your roots here? Is that helpful? And if you don't have your roots here, what are some other ways in which you can start from scratch, whether you have family here or not?
Well, I'll let Elizabeth talk about the resources, but just from personal experience, and I've worked with researchers too doing their own genealogy. One thing which is helpful but you don't want to rely on entirely is, like you mentioned, those family histories that are already done. Now, you hope the person's going to do accurate research, but you do not know. So even if you have those family histories, you may want to back up.
So I should be fact-checking Aunt Marge.
You should, and Aunt Marge would like that. I think a lot of times, too, even if you have those family histories, they might not actually have the actual document in there. It may just describe the document, and sometimes seeing the actual document just brings more life to the story, because you could, like, we have the actual marriage records in our collection. You can see the marriage record from the 1800s that your ancestors signed. There's life to that. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I think that's one thing that you want to get close to, those documents that your ancestors had touched, actually physically, many times. And also, if you're starting, this is at least my suggestion, you have to have some family information already. You have to talk to your family. So if you do not have good ties with your family, I don't know, it's going to be tough going for you. But I would suggest the census, and the 1940 census is the first available census that you can look at. So from just as a personal hobbyist, that would be my suggestion.
So what list of questions would you have for, say, I'm assuming you would want to shoot for the oldest person you know in your family. What list of questions would you want prepared to start that process?
Well, it depends on what you're looking for, too, when you do your genealogy. Of course, you have to trace back your ancestors, but what makes them come alive are their stories. So you definitely want to get, you know, who was great-great-grandma? What was her maiden name? Don't forget those maiden names. Sometimes I think we focus, you know, on the fathers too much, but you're going to have so many other branches, you know.
Sure.
So don't forget to get the maiden names. Get the stories. And sometimes the stories are not correct, but that's still part of your family story, your family legacy. I was always told I was French, Irish, and Welsh. I did the research. I haven't found that that's true, but it's what I was told. So it becomes part of the family story.
Now, we'll get into oral history later. I think that's interesting, but how do you think that became incorrect?
Well, I think you have to think about history. I mean, when you do family history, you learn about history. You learn a personal connection to world history. And when you think about countries were not always, you know, their political states, and they change. And one thing I believe with the Welsh, and, you know, as you go back in time, things get fuzzier, and there's not as many documents. And I believe this ancestor, they thought he was from Wales, but we're not sure. Maybe he was from England. And as more research was done, it's looking more like he was from England. Then with the French, I believe, was a German group that spoke French and was close to France, but not actually from France.
Interesting.
So maybe some French
or maybe
cultural.
From the Alsace-Lorraine region.
Right, exactly.
Changed.
Exactly,
politics.
It changed, exactly. And then also, actually, and I misspoke, I actually did prove the Irish, but I mean, that's one out of three.
So Elizabeth, what if, say we do know we have roots here in Monroe County, what are some of the resources at the Monroe County History Center Library that somebody could use to research their own personal genealogy?
Well, I have to say, if you are a Monroe County genealogist, you are very lucky. Because of the History Center and because of the time that has been put into preserving our history there through many volunteers who have worked on different resources that we have a large set of family files. These were all donated by one local genealogist who had worked on multiple family lines. I mean, I think we have about 800 files was the number that I saw recently of different surnames. So he had researched this many different families and kept the files and donated them to the library. So we have those. That's one of the first things that I would turn to if someone walks in the door and gives me a couple family names that they're working on. I would probably give them a family file first because they can see what's already been built, what other people have found, and then they can compare it with their own notes or look to verify some of the information in there. But it's a good starting point just to see, well, what have other people done? And we've added to those family files as other people bring in their information. We also have a large collection of news clippings. Many of them are on 3x5 index cards. Those have all been created by volunteers who have put the original news clippings using contact paper on these cards and indexing them. So we have a large collection of those, as well as longer news clippings that are in envelopes, and you can see the original newspaper.
And how are those useful?
You can...
Those have obituaries and marriage announcements?
Yeah, typically they would be marriage announcements and obituaries, birth announcements, also some gossip news. Mary is visiting her aunt, Virginia, in the next door county, or somebody...
Things that were news back in the day.
Exactly, somebody having a party, a lot of gossip columnists. I say... They're kind of like Facebook statuses of today. They're very trivial bits of news. But if that's, you know, your family or someone you're looking for, that trivia is really interesting, or it gives you just information that you couldn't get from an official record.
Now, Angie, you've probably had many revelations yourself, and then Elizabeth, you've probably seen people digging through these documents, and all of a sudden they suddenly realize something. Talk about that feeling, either to observe or to experience yourself, when you all of a sudden find out something new, or maybe find a link in a chain that had been previously broken.
Well, for genealogists, that's called hitting the brick wall. And certainly if you've been working on an ancestor for a long time, and I do have those ancestors that their records are just not there, or where did they go? They were in the state decade after decade, and now they're not there anymore. Where did they go? And sometimes they just disappear. And so when you finally get over that brick wall, when you finally find out where that ancestor was in 1920, it's a relief, because you're like, finally, that's where she went. She got a divorce and she moved in with another family. And you're just like, that's what happened. And so it's a relief, and it completes the mystery. So sometimes brick walls are intriguing. At least they are for me. And I'm very tenacious. And I'm like, what happened to her? Where did she go? And so you can sort of solve the mystery.
I find it very gratifying, even though it's not about my own family, to help other people do research. Some people call in. We can do research remotely for people who live in, say, California, who can't come into the History Center. They'll email me with their requests. So sometimes I get to do that research on my own, and I sometimes break through people's brick walls too. And it's so gratifying just to be able to find an answer to something that can only be found by, you have to know the resources, and sometimes you have to make some guesses, and I'll talk to other people who are in the room. So it's an investigative process to find it. So it's exciting to get an answer in the end.
Now, you see, you know, web advertisements for Ancestry.com. What do you know about that? Do you think that's a useful tool for either one of you?
I do think it's a useful tool, but most people that use it have to pay for it. However, if you come to the Monroe County History Center, you're very fortunate because when you're in our library, you can use our library's version of Ancestry.
And that would link you to Ancestry beyond Monroe County
yes,
limits.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. I think it's absolutely a helpful resource. I was so excited when we got it at the History Center. One of our volunteers donated a subscription. We never thought we were going to be able to afford it, and we now have it. And for the first time, I was able to research my own family in the History Center because I'm from northern Indiana, and I was able to look up the 1940 census and see my own grandparents and great-grandparents.
That's cool. Now, so we talk about Ancestry.com versus... or in maybe in tandem with these primary documents that you could physically touch yourself. How do you think genealogists or people conducting their own personal genealogy, how do you think they'll do it in 100 years? Do you think all these documents that you two personally handle, will they all be digitized, or do you think that we'll still be able to leaf through the original documents?
I think we're definitely moving towards that. But I think, you know, there's so many documents out there, it'll be a very long process. And for me, I do like the tangible. So even if you can get all the electronic and you can actually get the image as many times as of the actual document, there's still something about being the physical presence of a document or artifact that belonged to your ancestor.
It would be nice if we could digitize more, but I think that people will still be going to local historical societies, at least for the next 50 years, that it's going to take a lot of time to get individual pieces digitized, you know, all those court records. We have thousands.
Sure.
They're everywhere in the building, everywhere.
Wow. Yeah, and I saw you describing the bath by which it is required to remove a crease, and you had a grin on your face while describing it, so I think you like the current method. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few minutes. You are listening to Interchange here on WFHB. And we're back. You are listening to Interchange here on WFHB. I am your host, Ryan Dawes. We're talking about Monroe County history and the Monroe County History Center as a resource for genealogy, among other things. Now, I'm here joining the studio with Elizabeth Schlemmer and Angie St. Clair, both from the Monroe County History Center. Now, Angie, you yourself have, you know, dove deep into your personal family history, and you've brought some documents here into the station. Share a little bit about what you have in front of you and what sort of revelations they had in store for you.
Okay, well, we've mentioned the census before, and one thing I found interesting when I was doing my family history is I was doing family history on the Denham family, who lived in Tennessee and then later Kentucky. In 1850, in the census, the family was listed as mulatto, which is mixed race. In the 19 census, the same family, no color was listed, but that was the same for all the families on that page, so the census taker just did not record it. In 1870 census, the family was listed as white. Now, see, this is one of my brick walls. I want to figure out what happened to this family. You know, at one point, the census taker marked them as mulatto, and then they were white in 1870. Now, when you go back to 1850, your census records get a little less detailed. So that is currently one of my brick walls that I am working on. So,
and no, Elizabeth, you also have a document that you found at the History Center that was it's not specifically genealogy related, but it just shows an example of all the interesting things you can find at the History Center here in Monroe County. It was circulated to the students and parents during World War II. Talk about what it is, Elizabeth.
I think this is a really good example of local history fitting in with national history. This is a mimeograph from the superintendent of Bloomington Schools to all pupils and their parents for how victory in Europe should be celebrated. And it's detailed to the point of if victory in Europe is declared before noon or after noon, what the celebrations will be at the public square and how the schools will deal with these public celebrations. The most interesting thing about this document, though, is the date at the bottom. It's September of 1944, which was 8 months before victory in Europe was actually declared. So it's really overconfident in its planning. And attached to this on the second page was an announcement saying that, remember those plans we sent out last September? Those plans are void. And instead, it describes that when victory in Europe is eventually achieved, that the results will be a little bit more sober and that they will instead keep in mind that the war is still going on in the Pacific, and it ends with every pupil and employee is expected to remain at his post.
Not quite as enthusiastic as the initial. Well, interesting. That is history right there. Now, the Monroe County History Center also has a oral history program. Talk a little bit about that and how you go about conducting. We actually have a clip we're going to play for you here in a few seconds, but talk a little bit about what this program is and what is its goal.
We began collecting oral histories about a year ago and have collected, I think, 14 new interviews. Our purpose is to learn more about the communities of Monroe County from people who are living today, what they've experienced in their lifetime. And we've interviewed people from communities outside of Bloomington as well as communities within Bloomington. And the clip that I brought today is Marion Jacobs, who is from Ellettsville. His family are among the founders of Ellettsville. And he was also a principal of Smithville Schools for years. And this clip is him talking about his own genealogy and information on his family history.
And is it you conducting the interview?
It is, yes. This is Marion Jacobs and I talking.
So bear in mind while you're listening to this, when and why I like listening to this is that it's not only, you're not only getting information, you're not only getting family tree information, ownership information about, you know, the history and politics, but also you're getting one man's sort of emotional view of these things and how he sort of regards these individuals in his life. And that, I think, is just reveals just as much honesty. Lewis, will you please play that clip? It's Marion Jacobs talking about the Ellets family, after which, of course, the town of Ellettsville is named, and Marion Jacobs himself is a descendant of the Ellets family.
Mm-hmm. And then Samuel Ellett, he built the first courthouse in Monroe County. And I'm descended out of Edward Jr., which was Samuel's brother. And my Samuel Sr. and Sam, or Edward Sr. and Edward Jr. died within just a few hours of each other in 1833 of cholera.
Oh.
And we know approximately where Edward Jr. is buried, but we're not sure where Edward Sr. is buried, even though Donnie Matson, who seems to know quite a bit about Monroe County history, he says it's Oh, it's off McNeely Street, back up in... As if you go into Ellisville, it'd be Edward Ellett Jr. is buried off to the right. Just as you... Along the creek there, I don't know if you're familiar with it or not.
I'm not very familiar with Ellettsville. I need to visit.
He's buried in there. They've got a marker for him. In fact, I've been thinking about trying to get the state highway to put a sign up there.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Betty Yoder wants to do that. You know Betty?
Mm-hmm. I know Betty.
She said, I'll do that. Work with the DAR ought to work mm-hmm. to get that done. So we know approximately where he's buried. And then his wife is buried up in the Presbyterian Cemetery. The rest, like the rest of the Ellett, several of the Elletts. Even though there's an Ellett Cemetery out over in Bean Blossom Township. I forget which one. I don't know if that was Samuel's family that went further out that way or not. I tell you, I get confused on reading all
that. Oh, that's okay. But I just wondered what you knew.
My grandma used to tell me quite a bit of stuff. My grandmother was an Ellett. And her father was the son of Edward Jr. So we're direct descendants. And actually, the town was named for Edward Jr. because he used to run a store, sold whiskey. In fact, we've got receipts. I've got a bunch of receipts where it has it, or so-and-so bought it. A fifth of whiskey or something,
mm-hmm.
and then they'd buy it on credit. And then when the bill was paid, they tore their name off of it. So I've got some mm-hmm. of those out there, and I wonder if you want them in here.
Sure, yeah.
Because the Archangel...
So he was selling a lot of whiskey, was that?
Well,
or are you just mentioning that was one thing he sold?
Well, I was one of the main commodities.
Main yeah. commodities,
yeah.
Okay.
And he operated a sawmill, I think, grist mill. I think they did what they had to do to make a living,
mm-hmm.
survive. Yeah. But they were Scotch-Irish. Tough old birds. They had to be. But my grandmother's father died when he was like only 31 years old. And he'd been a stockbroker or something during the Civil War. He would, something about he, people would buy their way out of the military and he insured them some way, and he went to the bond of several of them. I think he even lost his tail in the Civil War, financially.
So that was Marion Jacobs talking with Elizabeth Schlemmer here in the studio with us. And now what I want to know, I like this because you hear... kind of how he speaks admirably about his family. You know, they did what they could to survive, and this, you know, may not be relevant to anybody but his family. So why are we keeping these, and you know, how valuable all are these voices who can recall so far back?
Well, I think even if it's not your family, it's part of your human family. And just this particular individual, his family was from Ellettsville. You know, his family was where From Ellettsville got its name. And when you look at your family history, just like when you look at anybody else in the world, meeting them, person you don't know, you see the similarities and the differences that we all have. So that's why I think it's important.
And Marion conveyed so much information in such a short amount of time compared to what you might be able to glean from 10 different documents. If you could imagine, if you could interview one of your ancestors, well, that's what we're doing now. We're just interviewing someone who is living today, but their full story we can pick at so many different questions and get all the answers in one place and be able to go back and read through that.
Now, Angie, you were talking earlier about how when you were diving into your own genealogy, you said that what you were told as far as, you know, the nationality of your descendants, that kind of changed throughout your research. Do you ever worry about maybe how oral history might have these holes in it? It's no less true because this person believes it and that's what's passed down, but then it maybe changes due to, you know, anything as arbitrary as borders, or maybe just that's what they were told. So how do you, are you seeking like a truth with a capital T, or are you looking for a specific version?
No, I'm not looking for truth with a capital T. I'm looking for the story. That's what makes things come alive for me. That's what makes history come alive for me, is the stories. You want those stories to be accurate. You want them to be as true as they can be.
Sure.
But even the stories that aren't true are interesting. And you're like, well, how did they decide that was the story? I had one ancestor that, and I still don't know if this is true, but it's a family story, that the last name was Keys, and the reason why he got the name Keys was because he was one of those babies found on the doorstep with keys around his neck. Now, that sounds like one of those stories like, you know, I'm related to royalty or I'm a Cherokee princess, but it's a family story. So it's interesting.
So let's talk a little bit about, we just got a few minutes left here on Interchange. We are speaking with Elizabeth Schlemmer and Angie St. Clair, both of the Monroe County History Center. Let's talk a little bit about maybe what are some events coming up at the Monroe County History Center, both near and far. I'm interested in both.
Well, on the day after Thanksgiving, on Friday in the evening, we will be having our annual Canopy of Lights open house. So when the lights go on,
sure,
on the courthouse square, we'll have our open house so folks can stop by and come in. You'll receive free admission to the exhibits as well as complimentary hot cider and pastries. And we will be unveiling our new interactive exhibits. This is a renovation of our permanent gallery. So we'll be changing the area where the Schmaltz Bear is, and also our schoolhouse exhibit will have brand new exhibits, interactive, a lot of exciting new things for people to see. So if you could come on by, it's from starting at 5 o'clock,
mm-hmm,
on the Friday after Thanksgiving. I'll be there.
I won't.
also, so you have in the summer times, I know the summer is a long way off, but there is a junior historian program. Angie, can you talk about that for a second?
That is the Gail Cook Junior Historians Program. It's a summer camp. We do 3 weeks in the summer. We won't be doing it again, but since we were talking about family history, this past summer we did family history. This summer I'm planning on doing art history. I'm planning to do a junior museum studies program. So those are some of the things that are coming up in the summer. Also, right now, I mentioned the voting exhibit on the second floor, and also our Kodiak bear, the Schmaltz bear. Right now, people have the opportunity to vote and give that bear a name. The bear does not have a name. There are several suggestions on the official bear ballot to choose from, but also others so you can put in your favorite name.
Got to name that bear. Now, also, you know, I'm intrigued myself. Maybe I want to scrub coal off of some old documents or put them in a bath to get the crease out. Now, talk about how people can, what are some of the volunteer opportunities at the Monroe County History Center?
Well, as the volunteer manager, I can say we have many opportunities, not just scrubbing documents. We have, Elizabeth mentioned that we have greeters. And when people come into our museum, we like them to be greeted, and so they know where they are in the museum, what they can do. So there's opportunities to be a greeter. We also have opportunities to help out in the library, not just scrubbing documents. We have opportunities in the collection department. We have opportunities all over the museum, and all they need to do is contact me. I'm Angie St. Clair, and also you can stop into the History Center and pick up an application to become a volunteer. We also have brochures that tell you a little bit about our volunteer program.
Nice. Excellent. Well, it's certainly been a pleasure Speaking with both of you, Elizabeth Schlemmer and Angie St. Clair, thank you very much for joining us here on Interchange.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So Interchange is produced by myself and Lewis Malone. Our executive producer is Allison Bektesh. You can find this and other WFHB news programming at wfhb.org/news. For WFHB and Interchange, I'm Ryan Dawes.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.